Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Wednesday, and that's always interesting. You always get an interesting mix of shows, and no exception this hour. Dr. George Delgado, our guest. Dr. Delgado, the medical director of the Culture of Life Family Services, and very, very fine doctor and ethicist. And Culture of Life Family Services, one of those cutting-edge kind of pro-life family practices that have sprung up around the country, in part as a response, I would say, to culture of death in many parts of the medical establishment. Although certainly, I don't want to exaggerate that, not in every part of the medical establishment, but these pro-life family practices are really something, and they're doing a lot of great work. And Dr. Delgado is here to answer your pro-life questions. It's Pro-Life Open Forum, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So for example, you got a question about life in its earliest stages, and maybe you have a question about some medical difficulties that are encountered in the earliest stages of life, and what are the ethical treatments, or maybe you have questions about the development of the early stages of human life. You're welcome to call, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're pro-life or not. We don't hide that fact, and we want to share that, but you're welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884. More and more, however, the questions come at the other end of life as people become incapacitated, disabled by illness or injury, and or just by time. And there's more and more of a tendency in our society and societies around the world to find answers that are death-dealing answers instead of life-affirming and dignified and humane. So if you've got questions about the proper treatment of life, of human beings at the end of life, you're also welcome, 888-318-7884. And I'll just add one. It may be that you have a question having to do with the new biosciences, which Dr. Delgado understands, and I do not, but perhaps you do. You want to know about what's being done with humans in the embryonic stage of life. You want to know what's being done with fetal tissues from humans who have been aborted, or other innovations, let's say, using the most positive term we can for a biological kind. Some of which I don't know if maybe it indicates my bias. I'm mentioning all kind of evil, bad things, but there are good things too. And maybe you just need a clarification from Dr. Delgado. Is this one of the good ones or one of the bad ones? 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Dr. George Delgado, medical director of the Culture of Life Family Services. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's crazy times, though. I mean, I wish we could have you on and it'd be easy one day. But thus far, our society seems on a gallop towards trying out every possible death-dealing innovation. So I want to ask you about one, and that is, have you noticed there seems to be more and more news stories about ways in which human and animal, like, I don't know if it's DNA or body parts or whatnot are being mixed. Is there a good side to this story, or am I correct to be entirely creeped out by it?
Well, I think your gut instinct is right. You should be totally creeped out by it. And sound ethicists, even non-Catholic ones, really caution about this kind of research, that we really should not cross that line of mixing the genetic material of humans with other species, because it's really, in many regards, uncharted territory. And once you get in, you can get on that slippery slope, and who knows where you'll end up and whether you'll be able to stop what you create.
Yeah,
it's another good example of not paying attention to ethical boundaries and just pursuing science for science's sake, and sort of in an ethical vacuum. And that's really unfortunate, because you have those scientists who feel that they should not be constrained by ethics and they want to be the masters of all. And then you have others who try to justify this sort of experimentation by saying, well, look, think about the lives that could be possibly saved.
Right.
And of course, we know that good ends should never justify evil means. And that's really a cornerstone of good bioethics, and yet, of course, we've seen that violated time and time again when we see things like this, the creation of what are called chimera, yeah. where we have genetic material from two different species, or where you have the use of body parts from aborted babies that are used for research, or where you have embryos created specifically for research and then, of course, destroyed. So all of this is a very utilitarian approach. And what happens when you use a utilitarian approach is that humans are treated as commodities.
Right. Yeah.
And, of course, the human being should never be treated as a commodity.
Our number, the lines are lighting up, so there's lots of folks who would like to talk about pro-life issues. But if you'd like to call, you're welcome at 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You know, one group of people that it seems to me we always, maybe not always, but we generally leave out of our ethical considerations, especially when you talk about like editing genes or introducing animal genes into human beings, is the people who are going to live 100 or 500 years from now. And the things that we enter, even in a very small way, into the human genome now actually affect those people.
They really will. And that's one of the reasons why good sound ethicists, as well as the Catholic Church, strongly caution and prohibit the use of gene experimentation and manipulation on germ cells. Those would be the sperms and the eggs, because of the implications of passing on unforeseen complications, problems, or defects to future generations. It's one thing if I accept a treatment for gene modification. Let's say if I have cystic fibrosis, I have very bad lungs, and I take a gene therapy where the genes go into my lung cells and alter them. Because let's say if that goes awry, the treatment doesn't work the way I thought, well, they're my lungs and it's just me. But if those genetic manipulations are carried out on germ cells, then that could be passed on. And like you say, generation to generation, and we could lead to very, very big problems down the line. Not only that, they're also, besides just the pure, you know, people think of the genes as being the blueprints of our bodies, which they really are. But you think about how blueprints really are. You have the blueprints, they're drawn up by architects and engineers. You take them to a job site, and they're unrolled, they're put on a table, and then the foreman looks at it and tells somebody on his crew, okay, do this and that over here. They go out and do this and that over here, so they kind of interpret that. And it may depend on the skill of that carpenter or that electrician of how things actually get carried out. So you will get some variation. And you can think of that variation as what we call epigenetic changes. And we're finding now that there are things outside of the genes that change, that the genes may affect each other and other factors may affect how the genes are expressed. So you can get a magnification of these changes that can really lead to outcomes that are really unforeseen and could be quite deleterious. So we have to be very, very careful with all of this.
And as you said, they don't just affect the person. I mean, in a very short time, you know, if one thinks of the length of the life of our species, you can alter the entire species. Just with alterations in a person today.
That's right. You certainly could. You know that, for example, how many people in the world have blue eyes today? Millions and millions. We know by scientific studies that it's pretty assuredly concluded that blue eyes came from one person who had a mutation, and then from that person, all the blue-eyed people came. Or the number of people you can be traced back, for example, to Charlemagne.
Yeah, right.
It's a huge percentage of our population. And so, yeah, the ripple effect could be huge.
Yeah, yeah. So just to be clear, you're saying that blue-eyed people are mutants?
Well, they started off as mutants.
Okay, just wanted to be clear on what we were saying there. I'm not really good with science, but that's what I heard. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. We got a bunch of people on the line. It's a pro-life open forum. We got to take our first break, and then we'll come right back and try to get to as many calls as we can this hour, right back after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connection's set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Raymond Arroyo.
Part of the success we've had on the world over, I attribute to the audience, my relationship with Mother Angelica, and her teaching me that when you sit with someone, you talk to them, and you create an environment where they will tell you things they wouldn't tell anyone else. That ease, that humor, that warmth, she gave me that, and that's what I try to impart and make a part of every interview we do on the world over.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV and radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Dr. George Delgado, medical director of the Culture of Life Family Services. But that's not your, that's not the only hat you wear, doctor. What else are you up to these days? I know you've got some things that are of a more national scope.
Yes, so I'm the president of Steno Institute, which is a nonprofit institute dedicated to education and research around abortion pill reversal. And that's been going on for a few years. And also the president of Delgado Medical Consulting, which is an organization dedicated to providing medical direction for companies that are small and mid-sized and can't afford to hire a medical director, so it can give medical advice to different companies, keep people healthy and back to work, as well as providing expert medical legal testimony for different cases.
Oh, all right. And the abortion pill reversal is really something that you've been an innovator on, but there's lots of people doing it now, and it's showing great, great promise for the woman, for example, who takes the first pill towards aborting a child and says, no, why did I do that? I didn't want to do it. And she can actually have a reasonable chance of reversing that.
That's correct. Yeah, we're very excited about that. There have been more than 2,000 births after a successful reversal that have been documented, and now over 1,000 doctors are on the Abortion Pill Rescue Network, which is run by Heartbeat International.
All right, lines full, as I said. Let's go to Seattle. In Seattle, watching or listening on EWTN, Aaron in Seattle. Thanks so much for being with us. Aaron, go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yes.
Hi, Aaron.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi. I am a practice manager that has been, I've worked at four of the major hospitals in Seattle, popping to each one of them thinking I could find a place that's got, you know, isn't breaking the rules for pro-life, whether it's euthanasia or abortion, or referring out to abortion, which to me is, you know, basically equivalent. And so for years I've been thinking about starting my own practice, and I'm just a practice manager. I'm not a physician. I don't have that kind of funds. And I just wondered if you might have any guidance. And of course, there's huge barriers to entry because there's already lots of, you know, big medical institutions, as well as, you know, sort of, especially in Seattle and other large cities, an antagonism toward anything pro-life. So would you have any advice on how to start a new practice that is a pro-life family medicine or internal medicine practice?
Oh, Aaron, what a great question. Thanks.
Yeah, that's wonderful that you're considering that. So the first question is, do you have a physician or nurse practitioner who's working with you?
Not yet. Hard to find them here.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so what I would do then, you know, what you could do for now is start developing a business plan and and you can, you know, there are lots of different models around the country you could follow. There's ours in San Diego, Culture of Life Family Services. There's Bella in San Francisco, which is just getting started right now. There's the Gianna clinics, which are mostly in East Coast and Midwest, which have several centers already. And then there's Christ Medicus, which is a health cost sharing organization that is into promoting and developing pro-life practices. There's also women's pro-women health centers, which is based out of Phoenix, Arizona, and they certify women's care clinics as being pro-life, and so they can give a lot of help in getting something like that going. So I would look at all those to kind of decide what your model ought to be, and design your model while you're looking to recruit a nurse practitioner or a physician. And of course, you're going to want to get some funding for startup costs, and look to Catholic philanthropists in your area. And once you have a stable business plan, if you haven't recruited gotten anybody yet, then you can more aggressively recruit, and you can recruit pro-life physicians through a website called One More Soul, as well as through Catholic Medical Association. So those would be good places to reach out, and you could have an exhibitor space at the Catholic Medical Association conference coming up in Orlando in September. It's a good place to be seen, as well as if you're going to focus on women's health, American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. I'm on the board of directors of that organization, and that's a great group to look at. And they'll be having a conference in early 2022, but you could look at their website and see if you can make some contacts there. So I think that's how I would go about it.
Makes sense, Aaron?
Very good. Thank you. I really do appreciate those insights.
Oh, God bless you for that question.
God bless you and your efforts.
It's a beautiful question. It's wonderful to think that she doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. That was a pretty impressive list that you just gave of people who are actually doing this pro-life medicine around the country.
Yes.
Thanks, Aaron. I appreciate that. Up next, we're going to an anonymous caller. Anonymous, thank you for your patience. Are you there with us?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Hi, go ahead, Anonymous, with your question for Dr. Delgado.
This is going to be, I guess, a hardball question. How would you talk to a woman that was, like, molested or raped, then impregnated? Then how would you get them to not have an abortion or what? Do something like that? How would you persuade them not to?
Thank you, Anonymous.
Okay, yeah, those are definitely difficult situations. The first thing, of course, is to always realize that all conversions take place in the context of relationships. So you can't just think you're going to come in and have a fancy argument, convince that woman, and there you're done. No, you have to really exhibit compassion. And what does compassion mean? Compassion comes from two Latin roots. First, come means like the same as co, means with, and passion in Latin means suffer. So compassion means to suffer with. So you have to journey with and suffer with that woman who is in such a terrible, terrible dilemma. That's the first thing. And of course, to be able to give compassion, you have to be strong spiritually. You have to be humble. You have to let that woman know that you're there for her, that you understand her plight, and that you want to genuinely help her. Then once you've established that rapport, then you can talk to her. And what do you say to her? Well, what I would recommend saying is that in a rape or incest situation, there really are two victims. And so, of course, the woman is the victim and the most obvious victim. And the second victim, however, is the unborn child conceived in sin. And so that victim is just as real as the woman is. And what does doing an abortion do? Having an abortion kills one victim, the preborn baby, but it also severely scars spiritually and emotionally and psychologically the second victim, the mother. So the abortion really is not helping either one of them. It's killing one and scarring the other, because a woman who's pregnant, whenever she has an abortion, she goes against her hardwired instinct to protect her young. You know that a mother would do anything to protect her young. And even though these women do freely choose abortion, they don't know that deep down inside they're going against that hardwired instinct. And that's why there's so much suffering after abortion, be it spiritual, emotional, psychological, and physical. So I would go about it that way and say, this victimization of both you and your unborn child in no way is correcting the evil that was done. In no way is it justice towards the perpetrator. If anything, it helps that perpetrator because it takes the evidence away of his sin, of his violation of that woman. Instead, the focus should be on healing, self-healing of the woman, protecting of the child, and then justice through the legal system against the perpetrator. And that really would be the proper course. And I think there'll be some women who when you bring it, when you talk about it that way, will say, yes, you know, you're absolutely right. And but they'll need a lot of support all along the way, because the tendency in our society where abortion is legal is just get rid of this situation as quickly as you can. But they often don't perceive that that action, that abortion, is actually going to create more problems down the road, individually for that mother, as well as, of course, killing the preborn child.
Anonymous, thank you very, very much for the question. I feel in you know, the job that I do, and probably you too, Doctor, in the job that you do, have had occasion to meet moms who have had horrible circumstances of rape and, as Anonymous mentioned, or whatnot, or, you know, similar situations of the conception of a child. And they're really heroic. They did not harm the child. They brought the child into the world. Some the child went to an adoptive family. Some raised the child. But I think this is actually, I actually wish there was more conversation about this, because I think it's more common than people realize that there are tremendous numbers of heroic women. But also, I think we have to remember that it's not an assault on women's dignity to point out that this, sometimes life calls for carrying a heavy cross and for being heroic. And Christ calls men and women to that in different ways. And many women have done it and deserve, even though I think this is not something people always want to talk about publicly, if we did talk about it publicly, then these that we would know that there are many more heroic women in the world than are currently we're getting credit.
Absolutely.
Anonymous, again, thanks. Christina in Dallas, watching on EWTN, you are up next. Christina, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yes, thank you very much. I just wanted to comment also about the previous call. I did meet someone 30 years ago who had been raped as a 19-year-old, and was helped through that whole period by some very wonderful pro-life people, and she ended up keeping the baby, and she ended up marrying this couple's son that helped her, and it was a wonderful marriage, and she was so happy she kept the baby. She was never able to conceive again, and that was her only shot at experiencing biological motherhood, and they ended up adopting 4 more children.
There, that's the thing, Christina. I appreciate you saying that, because I think that these stories of heroism are there all around us, and we deny them because we just don't want to hear them sometimes. But I'm so glad that you shared that story, and that child gets a full life because of that mom's decision. And that, what greater gift? I mean, she gave that child a full life on this earth.
Absolutely. Married, has children. He's wonderful. Okay. My question I'm calling about is I will be 60 years old shortly, and about 17 years ago, I had a small bout with cancer and completely, in remission. But I was wondering if in the future, 10 or 15 years from now, if I got diagnosed with cancer again, would it be ethical for me to deny taking any treatment for it?
Well, that's a good question. It all depends. The context is very important here. So if you decided to forego treatment because you wanted to hasten your death and purely for that, then that you would not be a good steward of your life, and you would it would be tantamount to suicide. So that would be unethical. But if you decided to forego treatment because the burdens of treatment would be excessive, or the chance of recovery would be small, or there were other good reasons to forego treatment, then you could ethically refuse treatment. So again, it depends on the context, and we often discuss things that are that are large burdens and small burdens, proportionate and disproportionate treatments. So that's why if it's a relatively simple treatment and the chances of success are very, very good and you have no good reason to forego the treatment, then you would possibly be ethically in the wrong there. But if there were something that were disproportionate, that means that a lot of risks and burdens to you and maybe the chances of success were not great, then no one would expect you to do that. You're never obligated to take disproportionate treatments or extraordinary means to extend your life. But if it's ordinary means, then yes.
Right back with more. Thanks, Christine.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Enter promo code EARLY to save $30. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Are you estranged from anyone in your family? That can be very difficult. Let's discuss it tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations. Now we return to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest, our good friend, Dr. George Delgado from right around here in these parts in Southern California, where he's delivered a lot of babies and saved a lot of babies, and he's the medical director of the Culture of Life Family Services and a great spokesman for life, also an ethicist trained by the National Catholic Bioethics Center in addition to being a physician, and also trained as a, what's it called, palliative care physician. So probably overqualified for talking with me, but nonetheless, he keeps coming back. Let's see who we got on the line next. Michael in Spokane, Washington, listening on EWTN. You are next, Michael. Thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call, both of you. We know life begins at conception, 4 to 5 weeks after conception. A medical test show a heartbeat. Doctor, my question is, the psychological effects of abortion are traumatic. Could you comment on this and ways to help these people, women?
Sure. And just to clarify your opening comment, life does begin at conception, also known as fertilization, when the sperm and egg unite, not right. 4 to 5 weeks later. So just want to make sure.
I think Michael was saying there's a heartbeat 4 or 5 weeks later. Is that right,
okay.
Michael?
Yep. I didn't know if he was, conflating the two.
I gotcha.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure we're clear on that. So yeah, there are, this has been studied extensively, and there's a lot of literature out there. There's a lot of biased literature out there where when they interview women who've had abortions, they They structure the questions in certain ways and ask them at certain times where they come up with results that suggest that not a lot of women have psychological problems. And so, so for example, there's something called cognitive dissonance we all experience, and that is when you believe one thing but you do another. Your brain doesn't like that, and so it's you're either going to change your behavior to conform with what you believe, or you're going to change what you say you believe or what you actually believe to conform with your behavior. And so right after a woman has chosen an abortion, she's going to say often, oh, I'm happy I did my abortion, and I feel fine, et cetera. And so, and it also it depends on what kind of questions they ask. But when other researchers ask less biased questions in less biased ways and they follow women over time, they see and find pretty substantial risks of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, what's called post-abortive disorder. And so the psychological effects can be quite profound with abortion. And how do we help women with these? Well, first of all is, again, to be there for them, to suffer with them, to be there compassionately, to form rapport with them, to be in relationships with them, to bring them to good Catholic counselors who understand this and who are very empathetic and who aren't just going to watch over it, and to know that it's going to take a long, long time. So it's a long-term treatment. It's not an easy fix, but it's a matter of relationships, sometimes support groups, and a lot of good pregnancy help centers will offer these post-abortive support groups. There are some hospices that offer them, and so that's going to be very, very important to have the support groups, but also have to have the counseling, to have the spiritual support, to make sure if the woman is Catholic that she's gone to the Sacrament of Reconciliation. If she's not Catholic, that she has done whatever she can to seek forgiveness from God, to also bring in the father of the baby if possible, because that man has abdicated his responsibility as a servant leader of that relationship in not trying to steer his partner away from the abortion. So we have to bring all of them in together, if possible. Of course, oftentimes they've split apart by then. The man may just need help on his own, but it's going to require a lot of therapy, support through groups, and spiritual support, prayer, sacraments.
Michael, I'm going to leave it there because, again, lots of folks have pro-life questions today. So thank you very, very much for the question. It's a pro-life open forum. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We go now to Grace in Montana, listening on EWTN. Grace, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Grace.
Okay, so I'm having a hard time articulating this question. I was sent a link not too long ago with a sermon on it by a priest. And in the sermon, he addressed the fact that, I don't know if this is for like embryonic stem cell or what, but that one of the things they did was that they would take the aborted baby and while it was still alive and without anesthesia, take what they needed from that child. And I don't know if this meant like sometimes you see HEK for human embryonic kidney cell or whatever and mentioned in a medicine line or whatever. But so I was trying to understand, is that the way that they do that? And is that how they, I don't know how you say that, you know, use these poor little ones?
Are they harvesting cells from living children? Right, in the fetal stage or in the embryonic stage. Doctor?
So the reports that I have reviewed are very suggestive that sometimes that has been done because some of the tissues, in order for them to be useful scientifically, have to be extremely fresh. And by extremely fresh, I mean the preborn baby still alive. And so I think with the work that David DeLeiden has done in exposing the embryonic and fetal tissue and organ harvesting has shown that in some instances they have deliver the preborn baby alive, taking the tissue out while still alive, in order to ensure that it is the freshest tissue possible. They also, there's evidence that abortion techniques were altered in order to spare certain tissues that they were seeking. This is in violation of federal law. And also, sometimes they do not, in some instances, they would normally use an injection of a toxic medicine like digoxin, for example, to stop the beating heart before they do the later term abortion. That sometimes they did not do that because they did not want to make damage any of the tissues. So the short answer is yes, there are instances of that having occurred. How often, we're not sure. But, the old saying, wherever there's smoke, there's fire. There's a lot of corruption, I feel, in the abortion industry. We probably have only seen a piece of it, and hopefully we're going to discover more, and hopefully these people will be brought to justice for their crimes against humanity.
Grace, does that address what you wanted addressed?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. It's very hard to hear these horrifying things, but I think sometimes we need to hear these horrifying things in order to understand what we're dealing with, because I suppose there's always the potential with us, Dr. Delgado, that the energy will flag and we'll tire of the battle. But when human beings are being treated in this way, there's no excuse for tiring. We've got to run the race right to the end.
Yes, we do.
Thanks, Grace, for the call. Let's take a break. I need a break. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more open forum, pro-life open forum with Dr. George Delgado right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with program info, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. Just go to EWTN.com/wings. Fill out your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. When you get yours, send it to all your friends, and they can send it to their friends. And pretty soon, we're covering the whole world with the good news about EWTN. Wings, the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We've got that Beginner's Guide to Biblical Prophecy. It's a free ebook. And by free, we mean free. You don't have to pay any money for it. You just go over to shop.catholic.com. We try to have a free ebook going at all times. And this month's, well, they don't always go by month, but you know, this the one we have right now, the Beginner's Guide to Biblical Prophecy, help you understand biblical prophecy, help you make sense of the prophecies in the Bible, but also understand prophecy more generally and what we're talking about when we're talking about a prophet and what a prophet does. Free right now at shop.catholic.com. On the line, Dr. George Delgado. It's pro-life open forum. You can ask whatever question you'd like about the proper treatment of human life from its earliest stages until natural death, and whether that life is being lived in a healthy way or is suffering disabilities or disease. Each of us has a beautiful dignity before God, and that means that there is a proper way to treat humans, and there are improper ways, and that's what we're talking about today. 888-318-7884. Up next, John in St. Louis, Missouri, watching or listening on EWTN. You're up, John. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, thank you. I heard a doctor or a scientist question the average criteria of brain death.
Oh, okay.
He was suggesting that it's a bad idea to donate your organs, that the criteria is usually applied in a way that's make organs available for harvesting and
when people are still alive.
People are not all the way dead. Yeah.
Dr. Delgado?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I agree with you. I think you can still safely donate your organs. And what I've indicated on my advance directive is that my heart, it should be beating. They should not only use brain death criteria. And you're right, because although brain death has been almost universally accepted, and even St. Pope John Paul II gave his nod of approval to it, I think we're seeing now that there are some fault lines in it, and that brain death, the way it's diagnosed, may not be diagnosing death of the organism. The organism is the person. And so really what happens with when the person dies is there's a disintegration of the of the coordinated control of the entire being, so that all the cells and tissues are working together. And we've made the assumption that the brain controls all that. We know the brain controls quite a bit, but the brain is not the animating principle of the body, that the soul is. And so, of course, the soul is something that's spiritual, and we don't have a way to measure it. So we can be good at declaring when death has already occurred, but to declare when death actually happens is very elusive and very difficult. And there are examples that illustrate this and that give substance to my doubts about the brain death criteria being rock solid. And that would be, there are at least a handful of cases in the medical literature of children who are declared brain dead, who nonetheless their parents kept on life support, and who eventually went through puberty. So puberty is an integrative action of the organism. It's not something that just happens haphazardly. It's a very well-organized, orchestrated, self-effected kind of process. And so to say that a person who's dead goes through puberty, it just makes no sense at all. There also have been people who've been declared brain dead who later regained function and then were obviously not dead. So I think that, that we really have to be very careful with this, because, like you suggest, if you declare someone brain dead and that person is not really truly dead, and we take organs out of that person, then it's the harvesting of the organs that kills the person. But the whole concept of brain death was developed at Harvard University, and it was developed for the express intent of facilitating early transplant of organs, harvesting of organs, because there was a problem of, again, like getting the freshest tissue possible, waiting too long, and the tissues and the organs were no longer transplantable. And so they're trying to get as close to the point of death as possible in order to transplant. But they may have picked criteria that sometimes put them on the other line before the patient died. And I think that truly is happening at least some of the time. I think sometimes people who are declared brain dead truly are dead, but I think other times they're not. And so I think it's not a precise measurement or indicator of death. And I think we have to be very, very careful. There are protocols for what's called non-heartbeating death. And so what they do here is a person meets the criteria for brain death, and then they take the person off the ventilator, and if they're on a heart-lung machine, take them off that, and they wait some period of time, you know, 1 to 5 minutes. And then if the heart doesn't restart, then you know, yes, indeed, that the patient is now dead, because we know that, you know, people don't come back from that. And then you can harvest the organs safely and ethically if you've waited enough time. But oftentimes they don't want to do that just because, of course, time is tissue, and time is tissue freshness and organ freshness. but we really do have to be very, very careful that, again, in trying to help other people, we do not cause the premature death of those who are donating their organs.
John, I'm really glad you asked that question. And Dr. Delgado, I'm very happy to hear your answer, because this is actually something that I will get letters and emails about and feel utterly unqualified. But it does seem from the emails and letters I get and the articles that people point me to saying, you know, you got to do a better job of dealing with this on Catholic Answers Live, that what was once a consensus is breaking down as a consensus. And it does seem that there is the general idea that there are nuances that need to be explored here that haven't. And it's much to our benefit if we just get on with it and start figuring out and don't resist, you know, because it's saving a lot of lives. That's too much casualness with human life. So I'm very glad you asked the question, John. And Dr. Delgado, thank you for the answer. John, you sounded like you had something else you wanted to add, though.
No, that was it. Okay. I could ask another thing, but no.
Okay, well, we'll let other
thank
people
you.
Get. No, you're very welcome, and thank you. Appreciate that. Just a very fine and very helpful question, an area that we need to take more time dealing with on this program. Rita in New Jersey, you're next, listening on EWTN. Go ahead, Rita, with your question for Dr. Delgado.
Oh, hi. I did not take the COVID vaccination because morally I couldn't justify it, because aborted children were used somewhere, somehow along the line in producing it. And now I just found out that an injection I get for my osteoporosis, Prolia, also uses aborted children some way. And then, so I would like to know how I can find alternatives, because this injection brought me out of osteoporosis into normal range. And should I stop it abruptly? And how can I find an alternative? And then I just found out that some food products use aborted children as taste enhancers.
I see where you're going, Rita. But I want to get doctor's answer because we're getting short of time. Dr. Delgado?
So lots of areas to touch on here. But the first thing is, I think people need to understand that you have the moral right to refuse any of these biologicals or vaccines that have some connection with cell lines that were derived from aborted babies. So that's everyone's moral right. So never, ever forget that. However, in certain situations, you do have the right to accept them if there's no better alternative and if their connection is quite remote. So that's why I feel that there are some people who morally can justify taking the COVID-19 vaccines and can morally be justified in taking, for example, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which also has a connection. But the other point is that it's becoming more ubiquitous that many, many products, whether they're medical or non-medical, do have some connection with cell lines that were initially that were derived from aborted babies, including testing of some flavor enhancers, testing of some, I believe, cola products, all sorts of things where they use systems that have cell cultures that where the cells were taken from cell lines that are initially derived from aborted babies. So it is quite ubiquitous. With the Prolia, you take that for about a year or 2 years maximum. So it's not something you take for a very, very long term anyway. So you could, talk to your doctor about maybe going back on a bisphosphonate, which you probably were on before. And these are medicines that help stop the breakdown of bone. Or if you had a really critical risk of fracture and there's no better treatment, you could possibly morally justify taking it, but you'd not be obligated to take it. So you will probably have some prudential ability there, depending on your specific circumstance.
Rita, thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. I'm going to keep going to try to get as many on as I can with Dr. George Delgado during this pro-life open forum. John in Boston is next. Always good to hear from civilization. John, go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Thank you. You don't have much time. Everyone needs to support Catholic Answers.
Oh, well doctor, said.
Pre-birth, a lot of imaging may show cysts. And in the most conservative way, we were told on our third son that, you know, birth defects and reading the whole Riot Act and saying that we should abort. He's doing extremely well at age 20. And there was nothing wrong. And then after our decision, of course, which was clearly pro-life and was worked out, we found out from one of the other doctors, as you know, there's strings and referrals and specialists. The initiating doctor said, well, cysts are relatively common. Have studies been done to bring out more truth that they're either common or just something that's seen on an image and that they're acceptable, that the child, like my son, will be fine.
Ah, yeah. Dr. Delgado?
Yeah, so, well, there are numerous different types of cysts that can be imaged in a preborn baby. So it all depends on the type of cyst. But essentially, it's true that they may or may not cause big problems. They may resolve and go away before birth. They may lead to big disabilities or little disabilities or no disabilities, even if they remain. So it all boils down to you really don't know. And what we do know is that there have been many babies who have been aborted because of abnormalities that probably would not have had a significant impact on quality of life. So I think the take-home point for the for pro-life people is that sometimes fewer tests are better, because what do tests do? They provoke a lot of anxiety. They lead to more referrals, more tests, pressure on the parents to abort or to do more tests. And sometimes it's better just to do the minimal number of tests, only do tests that will change the treatment plan. In other words, if a couple knows they would never abort their baby, well, why even do any of these genetic tests or these screening tests? Why increase the anxiety? Why do anything that really will not change the course? So in my practice, I see a lot of families that choose that, not to do all of these different screening tests, because they are simply screening. They're not necessarily diagnostic. They lead to a lot of anxiety, a lot of more tests.
That's what you were getting at, John, this idea that the people are being misled, in other words, by over-testing to abort children who probably there's nothing wrong with the child. Is that where you were heading, John?
Yes, and there is only one choice, life. That's what
sure.
my son would have chosen if he could have spoken.
Right.
I just meant it in terms of misconstrued data, and thank you for adding the layer about tests and all the horrible things that happen to mommy and baby. Just going on and on and on about it. But yeah,
yeah.
Only choice is life.
Praise God, John. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. It is so strange. You hear all these stories. I had one with one of my children where you're standing around with doctors and they're waiting for you to make a judgment on whether your child lives or dies. And it's just such a weird medical situation. And you say to them, well, you know, which we did in the case of one of my daughters, well, if we know this, is it going to change what you need to do in the delivery room? And they said, no, it doesn't do anything for us. Well, why are we asking? And they all just stand around looking at their feet like they just don't want to say. It's a horrible situation, because what we're talking about is, do you want to kill your child or not? I don't know. Do we lose Dr. Delgado?
No, I'm still here.
Okay. Dr. Delgado, thank you very, very much. Do you have a website where people can reach out to you or find out about you?
Sure. You can go to colflfs.org, stenoinstitute.org, and delgadomedicalconsulting.com.
Well, thank you very much. Specifically, or especially thank you for all the work you've done on behalf of the abortion reversal. Something I think many people didn't think was possible, but you're a pioneer in that area, but also for your ongoing and continuing defense of human life. I hope we'll do this again soon, Dr. Delgado.
I hope so, too, and it's a privilege being part of it.
That's it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.